Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 101 for May 5th, 2011. Burns, baby, burns. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store.
Well, good evening, everybody. Don't adjust your dial. John will be here shortly. He's at an engagement, and he will join us momentarily. Tonight, joining me is Frank Marcus from Motor Trend. Frank, it's good to see you.
Always a fun time to be here.
And we'll have Larry Burns up here in a few minutes. But what's on your mind this week, Frank? What's going on with the news?
Well, I don't know. You know, today I was at the Automotive Press Association's Michelin Challenge Design event, which is always fun. There's, four designers up there gazing at their crystal ball, looking at, you know, what's the urban mobility going to be like in 2046. So, and of course, our pal Jim Hall was moderating, so it kept it lively.
Did everybody get a word in edgewise?
Or? Amazingly, yeah, somehow. He managed to let that happen.
Good. Well, we see GM's earnings, which looked impressive until you started to delve into it a little deeper. I mean, they had a one-time...
it's a big tax.
Yeah.
Carry forward.
Big incentives. I think there's still some... questions about GM. I mean, I don't think they're running all up to speed yet, and I think this report was gaudy, but when you delve into it, it's not so good. It's good. I mean, make no mistake, but...
And the efficiency numbers relative to Ford looked, you know, pretty encouraging,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, there's no question that GM's product push is paying off.
Yeah, and their the quick rinse contract purge.
It doesn't hurt that, you know, all that overhead was... just erased, which helps. But, you know, not to take away from the product development folks and Mark Royce and his people, or, you know, and all the people who made the decisions for the products that are out now, which were 3, 4, 5 years ago.
So, right.
Kudos to them. But, they acknowledge they have a lot of work to do. So,
and we just got to hope that Mark Royce has got enough support for the neat stuff he's...
I think he does. I think as long as the people who really don't understand that part of the business let him do his thing and his talented team of people, then they'll be okay. As soon as the instant experts try to meddle, though, that's when things usually go wrong.
Right.
So what else? You said you're driving an Audi TT RS?
TT, just the mirror.
I've got the RS on your brain. What do you think of it?
You know, it's a great four-season sports car. I'm not sure my $50,000 would go to that car. That seems a little rich. But, you know, the dual-shift gearbox, marvelous. Great power out of that engine. Scoots around great. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Now, the RS coming is going to have something like 345 horsepower.
Yeah.
And you were just wondering, I mean, who knows how much? I assume it's going to cost about 60.
Right. And, you know, you start thinking, well, how much Cayman could I get for that kind of dough,
Cayman,
you know? And
Cayman.
Won't be
Cayman
the same amount of power, but, man, that, you know, delicious steering and that weight distribution like you want it. And, you know, that would be a compelling...
So you're working on a new issue of Motor Trend?
Yes, out the door very soon.
Give us a little preview of some of the highlights?
We will be. I probably can't without getting my hand slapped. But a lot of great stuff in there. It's old and some new. Actually, it's that the cover has a very interesting cover concept. There'll be three different covers, and you'll want all of them. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Okay.
Yes.
Other big news today: the Donald is no longer going to be driving the Indianapolis 500 pace car. Which he never should have been invited in the first place. He has no connection to the Speedway. He has no interest in racing. Yeah. It's the 100th anniversary of the race. It was a real bonehead move on the Speedway's part. But then all of a sudden today, but there's been a groundswell of this is not right. All of a sudden today, he sort of resigns from it, saying the schedule. What I think happened is Indy got nervous. The PR was really negative. And they sent Donald a schedule because, you know, you really have to practice with the pace car.
Sure.
And I think he took one look at the schedule and said,
it's probably a confluence of a lot of things. Because, frankly, I think his credibility as, you know, as a smart guy has been doing this with his birther. Baloney.
I agree.
Come on.
But it's kind of insulting to the legacy of the Speedway to have him. I mean, any number of people now, some people say, well, they've always had celebrities. True. But this is the 100th anniversary. It should be someone with a direct connection to the Speedway. A.J. Foyt.
Yeah.
Mara Andretti.
There's plenty to choose.
Yeah. You name it. Parnelli Jones, Johnny Rutherford, Roger Penske. I mean, any number of people should drive the pace car.
Right.
So now that this is resolved, I think the Speedway will probably make a smarter choice. So.
Here's hoping. Look who's here.
Dudes.
Hey, John.
Hey. Oh, my God, you left my seat open.
Yes, we did, John.
You were expected.
I was expected, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, John McElroy.
In the house. In the house here, boys.
So we just talked about Donald Trump.
Oh, what a jerk.
Well, you
but
know.
He backed out.
Well, he backed out. Frank rightly pointed out it was probably a confluence of a bunch of things. Negative publicity. The Speedway got nervous. They sent Donald a schedule of, well, you know, you really have to be here for like 5-6 days.
Might have even conflated that a little.
They probably said.
Right.
And he just said, I'm out, which was fortunate, absolutely fortunate.
Right.
Because, I mean, 100th anniversary of the race, the guy's got no connection to the race, nothing. He's not an enthusiast, doesn't care.
I know.
Everyone wanted to see if his hair would blow.
That's good.
Well, he wears golf hats on the golf course, so I'm sure he would have worn some sort of a...
Yeah, but like you were saying, Peter, you pointed it out. It's the 100th anniversary. You know, get somebody who ties in with the history of the race.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, A.J. Foyt.
Any
number of people, I mean...
Well, my suggestion was put Ganassi and Penske in the car and let them co-drive.
That'd be funny. Well, they'll make a better choice, I'm sure, now.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about GM. The numbers were gaudy and good, but when you delve into them a little closer, it wasn't...
Yeah, Wall Street didn't like the numbers that much.
Well, that's that old adage, buy on the rumor, sell on the news. You know? Wall Street bought, and then, you know, GM reports the numbers, and they all bail.
Right.
So what else? What's on your mind this week? What are you driving?
I'm driving a Ford Focus. Real nice car. I got the titanium edition. They dropped off a titanium edition.
Yeah, very nice car.
And then you guys probably saw as you pulled up, we got a Chevrolet Volt that's plugged into the building right now, recharging. And I think, what do you have, Chip? Do you got an
750.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. 750i. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, we got some nice cars that were going here, but.
That's good.
Yeah, Focus is good, as you guys know. Well, sales. Did you talk about sales?
No, we were waiting for you, John.
Yeah. Well, April sales kind of interesting, too. The big shockeroo, that hybrids lost market share. And I find that very telling. And, I know the Prius is at a low day supply. They're down to 10 days right now. But, you know, I think the Honda's CRZ is at like a 68-day supply. So I don't buy this whole argument that hybrids are just down because there's low inventory. They were down almost across the board. And even more telling is if you look at the numbers from March to April, they dropped off a cliff. And I was sure that they were going to shoot up because of gas prices.
Well, let's not forget, we've got a bunch of entries now that get 40 miles per gallon. And, you know, nice cars. You're driving one of them. It gets damn near 40.
Right.
And, you know, I think people are looking at the costs and just say, you know.
I don't have to wonder, is a battery going to need replacing for big thousands, you know, if I keep it and all that stuff, yeah.
Well, you know, I looked up the numbers on the Ford MKZ, and we talked about this last week. You know, they're offering the hybrid version at no extra cost. And the take rate dropped in April. So with gas prices going up a lot, the take rate dropped just under 20%.
And that's a full-feature, really good hybrid.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, they're doing the same thing, obviously, with the Buick coming up, which is a mild hybrid. And, you know, it's considerably slower than the 3.6, which will be the no-cost option. It'll be interesting to see how that one goes, too. But if Mercury, if Lincoln with the MKZ isn't doing better than that, Buick's got to be kind of going,
Well, it's got to be a worry for anybody doing a hybrid in that, you know, for no extra cost, you get the MKZ. One out of five are taking it.
Yeah.
Or put it another way, four out of five are saying, thank you, I don't think I want a hybrid.
From what I understand, though, the MKZ hybrid does better in California.
Yeah, exactly. Lincoln said that the take rate, at least in Southern California, is 60%.
Yeah.
But the numbers are very, very small. So it's not as if, you know, that you're going to make a lot of money selling hybrids, even if the take rate is high in Southern California.
Yeah, and to change subjects a little bit, I mean, I wrote my column this week about Detroit, you know, in general. A lot of favorable press, you know, a lot of people getting on the bandwagon, but I just, you know, wanted to make sure everyone did a timeout and realized
that. And that's necessary, Peter. And, but, you know, look, I'm one of the biggest cheerleaders because, thank God, compared to where we were 3 years ago, it's like, man, you know, we're coming back. But to your point, we're not back yet.
No.
This is a very tenuous recovery for the U.S. economy. I do believe that the Detroit Three are going to do, that their best is yet to come.
Yes.
But we're not there yet, and you don't know what could happen.
Yeah, and so I don't want to see any high-fiving or hear about any high-fiving anywhere because they've got a long way to go. And there are a lot of forces that could derail it quickly, too.
Right.
And now they're saying, you know, gas is starting to drop at the barrel price level, and they're saying, oh, we're going to have lower gas prices by July. I still think four is the new bottom. You know, if it drops, it's not going to drop much below four again. And
oh, well, let's wait till Larry Burns comes on here, and then we'll debate all that, too, because I personally believe that this new drilling technique, fracking, is a game changer. I think it's one of the biggest game changers in our lifetime.
And that's in our friends in Canada have. You're talking about using it up there?
I'm talking about using it in the United States. In fact, one of the most intensive drilling areas right now is the state of Pennsylvania. And this fracking technique, which has
where oil drilling started.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Is this a technique that causes earthquakes?
I heard that piece today, too. Yeah.
I just thrown that out. I mean, yeah, Pennsylvania, I mean.
You don't want to frack and then put a dam on it, I think was the takeaway on that one. Yeah.
Well, look, you know, there's environmental concerns, and a large reason for that right now is that, mysteriously, fracking's completely unregulated. So these wildcatters have been going out and dumping anything down the hole. It's got to be regulated. It can be regulated. It will be regulated. I think that will get the environmental issue taken to bed, so to speak. But as you guys are probably aware, you know, this country is now awash in natural gas. Awash is probably not the right, you know, adverb to use. But prices have fallen about 50%. It also works on producing oil. You know, the U.S. production of oil, I think, peaked around 1971. It's been dropping every single year since. What the American Petroleum Institute is saying is that U.S. oil production will go up 20% this year. Not a little amount, 20%. And this fracking thing's only just getting going. To date, it's pretty much only been done in the United States. It's going to spread worldwide. And that's why I say I believe this new technique is a game changer.
So we'll have a 99-cent a gallon gasoline soon? Is that
well, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying
So what is fracking?
Well, fracking is there's two parts of it. They figured out how to not just drill horizontally, but or vertically, but also horizontally. So, like, if you think the way that we've been extracting most oil in the ground, it's like plugging into an underground swimming pool and sucking it all out. But there's a lot of oil and gas trapped in shale, which is more like a sponge. So you have to hit a whole bunch of different areas all at once. So what they do is they go down, they go out vertically, and then they pump in water at extremely high pressure mixed with sand. It fractures the shale, breaks the shale. The sand is in there to keep all the cracks from collapsing on themselves, keeps it porous. Then you just suck the gas and or the oil out of there. And it was a couple of Texas wildcatters who everybody told them, can't be done, never work, absolutely impossible. Well, they didn't take anybody at their word, went out and did it for natural gas. And then somebody said, hey, I wonder if it works for oil. And all the experts said, nope, could never work for oil. Well, guess what? It does. This was 5 years ago they came up with that.
Jed, move away from there.
Right. One day while shooting for some food. Yeah, except they're shooting it with fracking now.
I do understand the earthquake thing, though.
So what else? You wrote about Detroit not being back.
Well, they're off the mat. Right. I just don't like to see.
Beat your chest.
There's a lot of ball and the stick and ball media is getting on the bandwagon. Oh, Detroit's this, Detroit's that. They got a long way to go.
Right.
Just keep your heads down. Keep focused. We'll all be better off that way. Follow what Ford's doing. Follow what Al Mulally's doing. He's just like, I don't want to hear about any of that. You keep focused on what we're doing.
Well, and that's why I think Mulally's been so successful. Stick to the plan. Review it every single week. Stick to the plan. Yeah. Review it every single week. Find out where we're falling behind. Divert resources to get it back on track. And
build good stuff and...
Of course, they started with a good plan, and I'd rather see a really good plan poorly executed than a really poor plan brilliantly executed. So, but Ford's hitting it both ways, a very solid plan, and they're executing really well.
Yeah.
So, well, maybe we ought to take a commercial break and then get Larry Burns on stage, as it were. Ben, let's run our first commercial break. With gas prices where they are these days, if you're after fuel efficiency, you need to check out the Hyundai Sonata. There's three different models to choose from. The 2.4-liter GDI, which delivers a segment-leading 35 miles per gallon. Then there's the 2-liter turbo, which offers 274 horsepower, yet delivers 33 miles per gallon. And the brand-new hybrid that provides a combined 37 miles per gallon. And you can learn a lot more about each one at HyundaiSonata.com. Larry, it's great to have you in the studio here.
Thank you,
John. Just tremendous. And again, for anybody who's listening and doesn't know, Larry Burns was, I can't remember the exact title, but you were in charge of all research and development at General Motors.
That's correct, yes. I had that opportunity from 1998 until September of 2009. It was a great job.
No kidding. I mean, it's got to be one of the best toy boxes in the world.
Yeah, tremendous. Unfortunately, during that time, the leadership of the company realized technology was going to define the industry and supported it, even though we hit some rocky roads there. But we had a chance to do some pretty exciting work.
So I'm dying to ask you a million questions, so let's just jump into it. Where's hydrogen going? Because you have been a real big proponent of getting to a hydrogen economy with fuel cell cars. But while I think fuel cell cars have made really good improvement, I don't see any infrastructure being built to make them a possibility.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case in the United States. But where you really need to be looking is Germany and Japan in particular. In fact, in a couple of weeks, I'll be going to Germany, Berlin, and visiting a number of hydrogen stations. Germany has a plan to go from today to the year 2020 and have 1,000 stations in place in 2020 to hopefully support about 600,000 fuel cell vehicles. It's a very well thought out plan, city by city, autobahn by autobahn.
And they're dispensing compressed?
Yes, it'll be. The industry is going to really sort out on compressed hydrogen, high
5,000, 10,000,
10,000 PSI, the PSI 700 bar hydrogen. The you mentioned fracking earlier and natural gas. I think that is a game changer, John. You can use the natural gas three ways to propel a car. You can compress it and burn it. You can make electricity and plug your battery in and recharge it, or you can strip the four hydrogens off the carbon and make hydrogen. And when you ask yourself, if you have a cubic foot of natural gas and you could use it three ways, and which one will you go the farthest? So I'll throw this out as a quiz question. Which one will take you the farthest?
I have no idea.
I'd have to bet on C.
C, it is. Yeah, you actually go a little bit farther on the hydrogen than you would the electricity, and you go a lot farther on both of those than you would compressing it and burning it. So the interesting question is, we have this windfall of hydrogen of natural gas in the United States, and as you mentioned, it'll probably spread around the world, but let's focus on the United States right now, a real windfall. Estimates of an extra 100 years' worth of natural gas from hydraulic fracturing. How should we use that strategically as a nation? Should we use it so that we could go twice as far with it by getting transition to plug-in electrics and fuel cell electrics, or should we compress it and burn it and use it half as smart? And I think that's going to be a really interesting discussion. But the good news is you can use it three ways in the transportation sector, and it's right here in the United States.
What do you see as the pathway to getting that going? Do you think it'll be, you know, central refueling buses and so forth that start with hydrogen, and that, or do you think like home refueling with the you know, natural gas to hydrogen, things like Honda is selling and so forth?
Yeah, one thing I learned in my career is to never pick one silver bullet. So I don't think it's going to be one thing, Frank. I think what you're going to see is a wide range of opportunities. And it's hard to predict because there's a lot of innovation and creativity going on, and that's what makes it so fun. But the one pathway I'm very attracted to right now is to take that natural gas by pipeline to a corner gasoline station. And you have an appliance that's much like a size of a walk-in refrigerator, let's say, for now, for sake of discussion. What does that appliance do? First, it strips the hydrogen off the carbon. Then it cleans it up, because you have to have pretty pure hydrogen for a fuel cell vehicle to operate. And then it has to compress it. Now, enormous innovation on compressors going on right now. And that's what's exciting. When you have an application, people get creative. Once you have it compressed, you have to store it at the station and dispense it. And you have to have a chiller to make that happen. So now picture this integrated designed unit that basically converts the natural gas to the hydrogen on site. Now, the estimates are on the order of a $2 per gasoline gallon equivalent cost for the hydrogen in your tank on that pathway. Now, if we're right and there's a lot of natural gas, the pipelines exist already, so that's not a lot of new infrastructure. The question is, can we get this rolling? And what's been fascinating to watch over the last 10 years is how innovative people have been on these natural gas reformers. Most people took refinery-scale technology, steam methane reforming, and tried to shrink it down, which is a good place to start. Now what they're asking is, what if I want to make 50 kilograms a day or 250 kilograms a day, and I engineer with a clean sheet of paper? That looks like it's going to cut the capital cost of that unit in half and double the throughput of the unit, a 4x factor on the investment cost. And inexpensive natural gas at $3 to $5 per million BTU, boom, could be a big play, John.
Larry was a big booster of the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation. I mean, he believed in the concept, and he agrees with us that if Indy wanted to project themselves into the future, either stage a demonstration race or something where you would allow a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle because the racers would attack all the problems, storage, delivery, yeah, refueling, pit stops, how fast you want to go, you know, as opposed to safety, how many pit stops you want to make. So Larry was a big booster, and It's too bad we couldn't get that going forward.
I think we'll see it someday, Peter. Yeah. You know, racing has been enormously important in our industry. Another race which you experienced with me in Victorville, California, John, was the DARPA Urban Challenge. And that's a second technology that's really capturing my passion these days. I don't know if you followed what happened from the Urban Challenge for the
totally.
Audience.
It's my first technology. I think that is the game changer.
It is. And I couldn't believe anyone worked as hard as John at this race. It was a three-day event. And DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, put a $2 million prize for anyone who could do a car that could drive itself. Now, GM entered because we needed the money because we were running out of cash. But we teamed with Carnegie Mellon. Stanford teamed with Volkswagen. But the fascinating thing was 85 teams entered that competition. 85 teams thought they could do a self-driving car 60 miles in a city setting, obey all traffic laws, and get it done in 6 hours. 35 passed the driver's training test, and 11 made it to race day. And GM and Carnegie Mellon was fortunate enough to win. But, Peter, that point about racing, it was all of those real things. We felt we had an advantage in the race going in because our team had experienced dust in previous races. Dust was going to be critical to these cameras. We also took the Chevy Tahoe we called Boss, and we knew we could pick up 6 minutes in the race by stopping aggressively and accelerating aggressively. So you'd never want to ride in our car. It'd make you sick. But it was a fascinating race. So during that race, these two guys there, Larry Page and Sergey Brin from Google, they end up hiring about 12 of these engineers, and they went quiet for 18 months, and then the New York Times broke a story that they had built 7 cars that could drive themselves on public roads, and they've tallied now 150,000 miles of experience on public California roads. They realized it wasn't against the law to drive a self-driving car as long as someone sat in the seat. You didn't have to touch the steering wheel or the accelerator or the brakes. So this is really becoming real now.
Well, not only that, but Volkswagen has shown us in the media a self-parking car.
Oh, yeah.
So you come to a parking lot, you know, by a restaurant, you get out, you tell the car to go park itself.
Go park itself.
And it goes nosing through a parking lot, finds a space, backs into it on its own. So unlike the technology that Ford and Lexus have, or Lincoln and Lexus, all right, Ford and Lincoln and Lexus have, you know, where you're in the car and, you know, it'll sort of back into a space. The idea on this one is, you know, you drop the car, have the car drop you off where you want to be, and it goes and parks on its own.
My whole thing with all these autonomous cars, it is not an engineering challenge. It's a legal challenge.
Absolutely.
Who are you going to sue? So I'm not holding my breath for any of these things hitting the market, you know, super soon.
You know, Frank, I thought about that a lot because I was a real proponent of that. In fact, I first started talking about cars that don't crash in around the 2000 time frame. Liability and privacy are going to be the gatekeepers, not the technology.
Right.
But I'm optimistic because of the consumer value that can be realized from it. You know, when secondhand smoke became an issue, it was shocking how fast the world in the United States moved on that. And you would think, my gosh, you're going to tell people that they can't smoke in public places or in bars, and lo and behold, we're there. So I think if the value is there, it will happen. Let me talk about that value a little bit. Let's say you're a $25 an hour person, and you could pick up an hour a day of your time because the car drives itself. Now, most people spend about 90 minutes in their car a day, so you take two-thirds of that, and you book it 5 days a week, that's $6,250. If you're a $50 an hour person, that's $12,500. You know, the best calculation you can come up with a plug-in electric versus gasoline, 15,000 miles a year, is $1,250. This is 10 times the value proposition because of the time factor here. So I think there's value, and it's a question of how are we going to work through the liability?
We'll work through it because, you know, when electronic throttle control first came out, didn't come out in this country. It came out in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's not that we did not have the capability of doing it. It's because they said, whoop, first we have to sell a bunch of these things in Europe, prove that they don't kill a bunch of people. Because when we get sued in the United States, we're then going to have a body of evidence that proves that the technology is doable. That's one. Then when you come to the Big Brother issue, too, or the privacy issue, we've had this in the data recorders on cars. We had a big fight. Who owns the data? Does the owner of the car own it? if they're leasing the car, is it the lease company that has access to that data? And so what we've actually found out now is that if in a lawsuit you want to go and retrieve the data from the black box, as it were, the data crash recorder, just like any kind of search warrant, you got to go to a judge, get a search warrant, then you can go and extract the data. So I know it sounds crazy, but all I'm pointing out is we will work through these issues. Yeah. And it'll take a decade or better. That's what it took with
And I've got to believe that the Chinese system streamlines an awful lot of that. And so a lot of this stuff will probably...
It could.
You know,
yeah. It could.
And that data, the data is critical because it turns out there's 37 kinds of car crashes. Now, when we first started looking at car crashes, there was a famous database called the Fatal Accident Reporting System.
FARS.
FARS, yes. And originally, GM scientists said maybe there's about 100. Then we studied it more carefully. We sorted it down to 44. And now the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says 37. So now you've got these 37 different ways you can have a crash. And the key is getting data to prove under which circumstances are self-driving cars safer. It's hard to measure safe. That's an absolute measure, but a relative measure of safer is something we think we can get at empirically.
37. Okay, there's front, there's rear, there's side, there's rollover. What the hell else is there?
Different angles coming from different streets and all kinds of circumstances. But where this technology is likely going to have an interesting play initially would be on interstates or freeways. So let's say you have to drive your car to the point where you're merging into a freeway lane. But at that point, the car can take over itself. And why might that be possible? We have full-speed range adaptive cruise control already. And you've got lane-keeping systems and forward collision warning on the S-Class. You can get that. And now you just simply say, let's fuse all that information, marry it up with some more
data. And some vehicle-to-vehicle communication, too.
Yeah. And now that's sort of the kind of tedious driving that a lot of us would like to pick up our BlackBerry and maybe check something. And so there could be an opportunity. It's not going to be one step from no self-driving to total self-driving, but
it'll come
make
in stages.
Good progress.
Definitely come in stages. But I believe that's the big game changer, because I think just making a car more efficient, fuel efficient, is one thing. But if you can now tell all sectors of society, whether you're disabled or old or extremely young or drunk, fine, take your car, no
That's
problem.
What the horse used to do. You'd whistle for your horse when you were drunk, and he'd drive you home.
The electronic horse. Look, I first learned about autonomy from Sid Mead, the futurist and designer, and that's how he described it to me. It's the electronic horse and the electronic herd. Yeah. And I said, what do you mean? He says, in the old days, the cowboy would stumble out of the saloon stone drunk, climb up on his horse, and the horse would go right to the barn. Yeah. And he said, and if you look at, you know, schools of fish or flocks of birds or herds of buffalo that all seem to move almost as if they're one group, he said, that's the electronic herd. He told me this in 1980, we're going to get to the electronic herd that operate, you know, the electronic horse that operates in the electronic herd. And
I can see it in the urban centers, you know, where you enter an urban radius of an urban center and you will, you know, some electronic thing will flash and say, would you like to hook up to the system?
And strictly because there's going to be 9 billion people on Earth and like 70% of them in cities in 2025 or whatever it is, something like that. So
to John's point, Larry's point, yeah, you will say, yeah, I guess. I will say, yeah, whatever. Press the button.
No, you're gonna push the Porsche down into third and
no,
that's speed only, all around.
That's
them,
only right? At night when I come off the grid. But no, I mean, I could see you pull into Chicago and you just say, okay, yeah. In Gary, Indiana, you flip on, okay, I give up. Just get me there.
Right. Hey, let's take another quick commercial break because we got to do that, and then we'll come back to this. But, Ben, let's run the next one. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Larry, what do you think, what's your reaction to what we were talking about before of hybrids just don't seem to be going anywhere.
Yeah. Boy, I was looking at the same data carefully. And, I looked at the March spike in Prius sales, and I concluded that had something to do with, the market dynamics of Prius trying to get out in front of the Volt and the Leaf and trying to prevent them from getting some traction. And that at the first quarter, it was 2.7% market share. Any car that had an electric motor in the propulsion system, that's how they measure it now, is 2.7% market share. So those numbers are not going to have a meaningful impact. Peter made the point about the number of really good cars out there that are approaching 40 miles per gallon, and I think that's the dynamic that you see. And that's exactly what you want to have happen. People always think about this one thing versus the other. It's competition that drives innovation. A few years ago, I looked at steel in the bodies of cars. At that point in time, half of the steel alloys and car bodies didn't exist 10 years ago. And you go, how did so much innovation get in the second oldest profession? It was aluminum. And it wasn't the aluminum on the car that was making the difference. It was what aluminum did to drive innovation to steel, and it's the high-strength, lighter-weight steel on the car that's saving the energy. So the hybrid is serving a purpose in the sense that it's improving the internal combustion engine, it's improving aerodynamics, it's getting to better tires, and all of those things are getting us to a value point and consuming less energy. So we need to judge these technologies not just in terms of their absolute numbers, but what they're doing to raise the entire system to a higher level.
Yeah, and because one of the problems, too, is that anyone with a calculator is going to have trouble making the numbers work out. The premium you pay for a hybrid, especially in a lease term, 3 years, forget about it. It's probably more like 5 or 6 minimum, and depending on how you drive and whatever, but hard to make that case easier on an inexpensive 40 mile per gallon car if you're really just concerned about make my transportation cheap.
Yeah. I tend to look at this whole subject in terms of mechanical drive and electrical drive. We've got a mechanical drive cars, and hybrids are just an assist on a mechanical drive car. Then we have electric drive cars, and a range extender is a mechanical assist on an electric drive car. So you've got this whole spectrum from mechanical to electrical. And on the electrical side, you have electric motors and power electronics, and all of that technology is maturing. And so it's hard to predict exactly where this will land. I think some of the inevitabilities that we're looking at is oil is problematic. Imported oil is problematic. Natural gas.
OPEC oil is problematic because we import a lot from Canada and Mexico. And personally, I don't have a problem with that.
I agree. OPEC oil is problematic. And natural gas looks like it's plentiful. So I think you're going to see some of this play out. And I'm kind of happy that we get these technology opportunities that are starting to mature. We're getting supply bases behind it. Now, the real big money gets spent when you scale it up. And that's where the auto executives are going to have to make some tough calls now is when do I start capacitizing a fuel cell propulsion system or a battery plant versus a new four-cylinder engine or new automatic transmission? Because these are big dollar decisions that last over a long time frame. And we're getting to those critical points. And it's not just a U.S. phenomenon, because what's going on in Europe is different than Japan, which is different than Korea and China. As a technologist, though, I feel a lot better where we are today than where we were 10 years ago.
What do you think, too, of some of the alternative approaches to hybrids? I'm fascinated by this EPA hydraulic hybrid, which seems to work very well in garbage trucks, delivery vans, and the like. Chrysler's now trying to see if it can make it work in its minivan. And this flywheel technology, both that we've seen in Porsche with its race car,
the 911
GTR,
GT3 RSH hybrid.
Thank you, Peter. And then this mechanical flybrid that I think Toro Track has teamed up with a company called. I'm just wondering, what do you think of some of these other approaches?
Yeah. I guess another big lesson I take away in my career is never write anything off. There are so many smart people. Just as an aside, the smartest 25% of the people in China equal the population of the United States. So there are so many smart people, and there's such a big reward for innovation. So what I see out there is a lot of people will take an idea that was before its time. They'll keep working on it. What we have now, materials technology is phenomenal. We can actually develop materials at the nano scale. When I was in engineering school, I was given the properties of materials, and I was told to engineer subject to those properties. Now you can begin to simultaneously engineer and create your own material. Our ability to control is phenomenal. Our knowledge about design is a general practice, fewer parts and design for manufacturing. So I wouldn't write any of those off. It does give us an opportunity to lower the scale economy of some of these plays and have more purpose-centric design. And I wanted to get to that point a bit, John, because really I think that's where the heart of the issue is. The automobile, as we've known it, is a general machine. And because of that, it takes on a certain size and a certain mass and a certain power and a certain range. And if we're really serious about some of these energy issues and climate issues, we're going to have to start getting more purpose-centric. Now, this is another little quiz I like to give the students, but what percent of the energy in a gallon of gasoline actually goes to move the person?
Oh, God, I'd say 25 to 27%.
Under 20.
Well, 75% of the gasoline's energy has lost its heat when you combust it. And the car weighs 3,000 pounds and you weigh 150. Therefore, 1% of the energy in a gallon of gasoline moves the person. We don't have an energy problem. We have a system design problem. And that's why this car that doesn't crash is so compelling, because that can let us get some mass out of the car. You get significant mass out, that makes the electric drive more practical. We're talking about concepts like the GM ENV, the electrically networked vehicle. There you're looking at a 4 kilowatt-hour battery. The Volt's 16, and the Leaf, I think, is 24. And when you get down to a 4 kilowatt-hour battery, that makes a lot more sense for 35-mile range in a city setting with a top speed of 35 miles an hour. So I think that's where all of this technology is headed, is innovative people now have this great big toolkit of proven enablers, and you're going to begin to see that. And then you're going to marry that up with what we're calling the mobility internet, the fact that we know where every vehicle is, and we can manage that traffic flow, and we can literally reserve a space-time path for you, and you can be paying for that opportunity to occupy that differential piece of roadway at that instance in time. Suddenly, we're managing traffic control. So very optimistic on that. It is a convergence of energy, transportation, and communications that's going to solve the problem, and it's not an energy issue. It's a design issue. Hmm.
Just think of the marketing opportunities. You mentioned something. You're going to go to Germany and look at these hydrogen stations, correct? But you said there has to be a chiller, or you have to cool the hydrogen, or...
Yes.
What's it called, a chiller?
A chiller, yeah, that's right.
Well, see, the marketing opportunity, if you got a 7-Eleven, they could big gulp the chiller. They could dress it up as a big gulp. I can see it starting all over again.
Yeah. That's good. But you have to do that because the rate at which you're moving the compressed hydrogen into the tank, and you have to.
Yeah, but you can see someone's going to say, well, it's a chiller. We're gonna own it. We're going to sponsor.
Your hydrogen Slurpee.
Yeah.
Larry, you mentioned materials. I find that fascinating that you might design the material at the same time you design a product. That's awesome. General Motors had been doing, when you were there, some real interesting work with what they call smart materials. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I thought we'd already see some of that in production already. For example, on the Cruise Eco, there's those vents that shut off part of the grill for better aerodynamics. Yeah. And I thought that would be operated by smart materials, but I guess it's not. So my question is, what happened to the smart materials?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what happened in that development program. Our first application of that was actually aimed at the Corvette. And it may still be in the works. John, I've been away for 18 months. I think all three of you know you get out of the information cycle even for a week in our industry, and you can atrophy pretty quickly.
You can.
But the smart materials do have a lot of promise. These are materials that change their characteristics with electrical fields, mechanical fields, or heat. And so they can expand and contract and return to their original shape. And you think of all the things that are actuated on a car and the ability to get rid of little electric motors and also get rid of some wires and things, I think they hold great promise.
Especially the shutters, you know, heat should activate that as a natural. I was very disappointed that was still conventionally operated, too.
The car you're driving has that, too, the Focus.
The Focus does, right, exactly. But that's not standard equipment, though, isn't it? Like a high-mileage version that gets that, or... I don't know.
I thought it was standard.
Hey, let's take another commercial break right now, and then we got to get into rapid fire. So, Ben, let's roll it. The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm. And a key reason is all the equipment that it offers. A driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStar, turn-by-turn directions, free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise. Ben, it's time for rapid fire. Let's bring it in. Okay, this is a point where we get to all the questions from our viewers. But the first one goes to Frank. Jeff W. wants to know, what's your opinion of the new Buick Regal, turbo and unturbo? And if you had to choose between the Regal and a pre-owned 3 Series, which would you take?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I mean, the Regal is a great car. My family, we actually have a TSX Acura, which is really the direct competitor, and it's in that space, legitimately. Personally, I'd have to have the 3 Series. But, again, you'd have to know you'd have to spend more money to fix that car. The Buick will probably last longer and so forth. So there's a lot going on both sides of that.
Okay, DC Auto Geek wants to know, can you drive a self-driving car drunk? Yeah, because you're not driving. That's one of the best appeals, I think, of autonomous cars.
There'll be an ET button on the dash if you're drunk. It's just a big red button that says home. You press it.
I became convinced that driving was the distraction. Why else would someone send a text message going 70 in a 3,000-pound machine? Right. So that changes the question what you want to design for.
T-Tom wants to know, in the case of a walk-in freezer hydrogen generator, what form is the residual carbon in, gas or solid, and how would it be captured?
It would be gaseous. I was using the freezer as a metaphor for size, not that you have to do this in a freezer. But basically, when you split the hydrogen off the carbon, then it would be released as carbon dioxide. Importantly, though, half as much carbon dioxide per mile as you would if you burn that in a compressed natural gas vehicle.
My suggestion is to make it into diamonds, because those are worth a lot.
That would be great.
Glenn E. asks, has John, Peter, or Frank driven the Honda Clarity? He says, I believe it uses hydrogen. Yes, it does.
Yes, I have not driven it.
Nor have I.
I have driven it about 20 feet, because that's all Honda would let me drive it, so I could get out and talk to the camera about it. However, General Motors let me drive a hydrogen Equinox all over Los Angeles to my heart's content, and it worked just fine. It was very impressive how it worked, as a matter of fact.
I drove in that vehicle when we were in San Diego. Mm-hmm. I forget which generation GM hydrogen vehicle that was. It's just like driving an.
They're electric cars with like hair dryer noise overlaid, you know.
Yeah. And that's the key. That GM built 115 Chevrolet Equinox fuel cells, and they've been on the road now for 4 or 5 years with real families. And it's part of that learning process, refueling experience, and they're working extremely well.
I meant to ask you, in Germany, what's the pump like? I mean, the original hydrogen pumps, you had to wear like a spacesuit to dispense it. But
the standards have moved past that. And in fact, even the original ones, you used to have to attach a little cable for static electricity. Even beyond that, we've learned on the codes and standards. It's going to be a refueling experience very similar to pumping gasoline.
There'll be 6'5" blonde German ladies who will pump it for you, tell you to stay in your car.
That will make people want to buy hydrogen fuel cells.
And importantly, in 5 to 8 minutes, you'll be able to transfer enough energy to go 300 to 400 miles, much like gasoline. Versus the plug-in electric, where we know you have to plug in for several hours to go 40 or 50 miles. That's not to be a criticism of the batteries, just a different consumer experience.
007 Mitch wants to know, does Peter think the automakers will be able to improve the state of racing?
Well, it's going to take the manufacturers. I didn't talk about my racing comments. It's going to take the manufacturers because I'm giving up on the factions, the various factions in racing, the sanctioning bodies. The manufacturers are going to have to band together and say, do a big time out, especially for road racing in the United States, and say, look, this isn't working. My column this week was about we need one great road racing series in the U.S. We don't need Grand Am, Speed World, ALMS, whatever, fighting each other. We need one great road racing series, or I'm afraid road racing is going to fall off the map.
Do you think the automakers will make that happen? Because that's really the question.
Yes, absolutely. I think the automakers are going to band together and have a summit meeting, and they're going to say, look, we need this to happen.
Another one for you, Larry. Why do you think Japan is important for hydrogen propulsion?
Well, Japan does not have very much resource at all, natural resource. They don't have oil. They don't have natural gas. And so they're looking for ways to get off of the imported oil. Their situation is much more severe with imported oil than here in the United States. It's been interesting to watch the Japanese OEMs because they were emphatic about the hybrids. And now when you listen to Toyota more carefully, they're really sending some pretty strong messages on fuel cells. I've asked myself many, many times, why would five auto companies, GM, Toyota, Honda, Daimler, and Hyundai, all keep fuel cell electric vehicle programs alive during the worst automotive recession we've all experienced when plug-in electrics are coming out? I think it's because all five of them see a value opportunity for the consumers. But Japan is in a very tenuous situation, especially with the disaster in the nuclear a tragedy that's happened. They've got some tough calls to make right now on the energy front.
You know, that's a really good point that you just made of five major manufacturers keeping on pushing fuel cells, even with all this other stuff coming out.
Well, because as we talked about several years ago, if you solve the problems of the fuel cell vehicle, then it's pretty hard to beat.
In fact, Jay Cujo wants to know, will the GM autonomy ever become reality? He says it was a really cool concept at the time and could be relevant today.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that is it may become a reality in the form of the ENV, the electrically networked vehicle. When you think about autonomy, it was four wheels, wheel motors. And we looked at it, and we said, well, Einstein said the best design is the simplest one that works. So why do we need four wheels? Why couldn't we do a two-wheel balance machine? So you basically cut autonomy in half. Now, using energy to balance your machine probably isn't the right thing to do, and the stopping distance with the brakes are more challenging. So I suspect the next generation designs of that concept might have a third wheel, whether it's a coaster-like wheel. But many of the ideas underlying autonomy are alive and well and charging forward. Wheel motors, by-wire steering, by-wire braking, changing the design architecture, all of that stuff is still alive and well.
Greg Denning from Vancouver, Washington, wants to know, can you flat tow a Volt behind a motorhome?
I don't know.
I didn't either. Hey, Ben, we've got a bunch of calls coming in. Let's get to the first one.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a question for all of you. Do you think the higher fuel cost in the economy will affect the value of older classic muscle cars in your, say, local hot rod? It seems like the values have stayed about the same price or even went down in value this last couple of years. Just want to kind of get your thoughts. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
So what he wants to know is higher fuel prices going to affect classic cars, older cars? Will they lose their value? Frank, you're shaking your head.
Not a bit. I mean, I struggle to put 1,000 miles on each of my cars in a year. The amount of gas that goes in them, it just doesn't make any difference at all. I have a Maserati and a Sunbeam, both of which get about 14 to 18 miles per gallon.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Most people with classic cars or even muscle cars,
they're going to keep doing it.
$10 a gallon, they'll still take them out on a Saturday morning for a run, you bet. Ben, let's bring in another one.
Hey, John, Peter, great work. Listen to the show every week. My comment is about the Lincoln MKZ hybrid take rate. Maybe we're not taking into consideration the product availability of the hybrid versus the gas engine. And also, there's no incentives on the hybrid version that there are on the gas engine. So as to where their MSRP may be the same, the hybrid is actually transacting significantly higher than the gas version with, you know, subvented lease and APR and cash rebate. And of course, the availability of the hybrid is much lower than the gas is, too. So I don't think it's as cut and dry as just people not wanting it as it is the other two factors. Keep up the good work. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Yeah, thanks. Good point. I had asked Lincoln if it was an availability problem, why the MKZ hybrid was not selling that well. They said it was absolutely not an availability problem. But you raise a good point. I don't know if there's incentives versus the gasoline and the hybrid.
Yeah, I don't know either.
So good point. Glad you raised it. We're going to have to look into that. Ben, let's bring in another call.
Hey, John, I was just wondering. This is Dan Smith from Durham, North Carolina. I was just wondering what you guys think of the new DiTomaso Pantera. I almost get the impression that General Motors, especially the Cadillac division, is sitting in as the sugar daddy for this newly resurrected brand. Everything seems to be coming out of the Cadillac inventory. I mean, engines, you know, powertrains, that sort of thing.
I guess I didn't get that totally.
I haven't
seen Diesel Pantera?
The Pantera. I just hope Shell Cavalli's not involved. But, yeah, I haven't seen that car.
I've heard about it, but I don't know enough about it to comment on it.
Yeah. We don't know. Ben, let's bring in another call.
Hey, John. Rick from San Diego. How much do you think the Chrysler 200 sales were increased by the ads, or how much from other reasons? And do you think the big three will be able to maintain their sales in the compact and mid-sized markets when Japan and Korea get their production and systems back online? Thanks.
Peter, you're the advertising expert. Do you think that M&N ad is really moving Chrysler 200s?
No, I think the incentives on them are moving them. I think the ad was a flash and, you know, a lot of buzz, but now there's big-time incentives on those cars. And to the second point, I think the domestics, well, GM and Ford in particular, are establishing beachheads in these compact segments for the first time ever in, you know, a long time. And I don't think they're going to cede much to the well, you know, I should qualify that, you know, Honda and Toyota, they're not going to cede much to them. Hyundai is the one. Hyundai is the manufacturer, and I mentioned my column today. It's not out to just be the biggest import manufacturer selling in the U.S. It's out to be the biggest car company doing business in the U.S. There's a difference. And you know what? Every time I say, well, they're not going to do that, and then they do, and then they do it better the next time. So I wouldn't count them out at all. So I think it's GM, Ford, and Hyundai battling it out.
Any thoughts on that, Frank?
I'm with Peter. They're high on the learning curve. Every new car is just way better than the one it replaces. Night and day, you can't believe they're related. They haven't got the ride and handling sorted out yet. They've got room to improve there. I don't think their hybrid is in a league with anybody else's hybrid. That Sonata hybrid is very, you know, sophomoric as hybrid designs go. But the next one, look out. I mean, I'm sure it'll be fabulous.
Yeah. Well, the key, I think, out of the April sales is if you combine Hyundai and Kia sales, they start come real close to Chrysler. And Chrysler is not all that far behind Honda. So there's a real battle developing here. I could see, because of the earthquake problem, Chrysler going past Honda this year. But I could also see Hyundai, Kia, the two together, going past the both of them as well. It's all going to be who's got the manufacturing capacity to do it right now.
Yeah.
But I think, Peter, you made a really good point. I've been saying all along that because of their legacy costs, the big three turned out some pretty mediocre product. I'm not going to blame just that. But when it was impossible to build a subcompact or a compact car in the United States with UAW labor and not make any money on the car, and you go into the program knowing you're going to lose every cent that you invest, well, you try not to invest much, and you try to keep the cost of the car down. So what have we seen? Cheap little cars, which open the door for the Japanese to waltz in, and the Koreans later, Hyundai, Kia. Them days, they're over right now. The walk in the park is no longer there. So, yeah, even when the Japanese get their manufacturing back up on stream, My guess is they're not automatically going to get that market share back. In fact, they may not get it back at all.
And, you know, design is not utterly unimportant either. And, you know, the Japanese are suffering a crisis in design as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
You know, the new Civic is just kind of, you know, and, you know, Corolla's due for redo. What's the likelihood they're going to knock one out of the park? Like Elantra. I mean, that's so good looking. The Cruze, also very good looking. The Eurocentric Focus, much better looking than the car it replaced, really makes those Japanese cars look dowdy. So, you know, you got that working against them, too.
Hey, we've got another phone call yet. Ben, let's get to it.
Hey, guys, great show. This is Jonathan out in Old Japan, New Jersey.
All
just
right,
wanted to
Jonathan.
Say thank you for a great show. You have wonderful guests this evening. Mr. Larry Burns, I'm a big Corvette fan, own a few of them. My question to you is, will the C7, if you took a guess, or the C8, have a dual-clutch transmission or an MCT computerized automatic transmission without a torque converter? I drove the technology in various supercars. I think the Corvette should have it, and I was just wondering if you could give any insight. You took a guess. C7 or C8? Thank you very much. Have a nice evening. Great show.
So, Larry, do you think that the next generation, the seventh generation Corvette or the C8 will get a dual-clutch transmission or an MCT computer-controlled automatic without a torque converter?
Wish I had that insight, because that means I would still be working with General Motors and be in the middle of the information. But I think there's a lot of capable people at GM that will sort that out.
You'd have to bet in favor, I think.
Yeah. The Corvette's just such an icon brand, and it's been a definer of so many technologies for the company. They'll make the right call there.
Yeah, well, interesting. This week, GM just committed some dough to the Corvette plant, which, on the one hand, for Corvette enthusiasts, that's a good thing, because the Corvette is going to be around for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
It's added 250 jobs in Bowling Green, Kentucky. That's all very important. On the other hand, the downside of that announcement is that the C7 won't be out till 2014. So we're talking quite a bit. And that means the C8, now Mark Royce mentioned he will never let the Corvette go as long as it has, which is 8 years or something. So that means the C8 will be 2018-19. So that's a little depressing, but go well.
Well, we've got this icon Corvette that, you know, bang for the buck, it's hard to beat. Would you like to see General Motors do an iconic alternative car, fuel cell or something like that, that you just know is going to be iconic and not going to be in big numbers?
Yes, I would. In some ways, the Volt may come down and play in that role. I know Icon is in the mind of the beholder, but it is a transformational concept. And, you know, the EV1 took a lot of heat for, you know, bad public relations and other things. But that team of people who engineered the EV1, they were the people behind the Volt, and they paid attention to those EV1 customers, and range anxiety was real. And this is a class of vehicles with a range extender, and it But we'll see. But I think that could prove to be an iconic car.
We've said it before on this show, but I'll say it again. I sure wish GM had kept the EV1 and also did like a little three-cylinder internal combustion engine version of it. You guys were teamed up with Suzuki at the time.
Yeah.
It would have been so easy to do and just let that program keep rolling.
You always wish for do-overs in the industry. You don't have them, but you go back to that point in time with the EV1. We should have put a back seat in it. We could have put the range extender on it at that point in time. Still a very aerodynamic platform. And quite honestly, we had hybrid concepts that were as good as any at that point in time. You mentioned before, we just never had the balance sheet and the cash to go out there and play offense in that time period. And so I think we were governed by the financial situation more than the passion for the industry. But to the credit of the engineers who did the EV1, many of them contributed a huge amount to the Volt. And they also contributed to the Equinox fuel cell. And that's what technology is all about, is learning cycles and just getting better every day.
And maybe we should end it on this, but talk a little bit about the there's a real shortage of engineers in Detroit right now. Not just super high technology. I'm told that for lighting engineers working on headlamps, you just can't find them right now. And you can't build a car without headlamps, and they better be good. Yeah. But talk a little bit about that. Are you worried? Because I've heard this my whole career. Oh, we're going to face an engineering shortage. And it really hasn't happened, except maybe now.
Yeah, well, I'm worried in total about science, technology, engineering, and math education for the nation, especially when we're competing against Japan, Korea, India, China, and other nations. There's no lack of talent around the world. The engineering education has changed a lot, too, and we have to find the right motivation for people to go into the field. I am happy to have been an engineer my whole career. I was once told an engineer is someone who likes to work with numbers but doesn't have the personality to be an accountant. I don't really buy into that, but it is just a remarkable experience to be able to sit down and take your education technically and think through a problem and see a solution and have a chance to have that solution acted on and turned into a product that makes a person's life better. There's not many careers that let you do that. And so, John, I am concerned. I know at University of Michigan, where I'm now a professor, a lot of attention is being given to that. The National Academy of Engineering is giving a lot of attention. We're going to have to work real hard to rebuild that fire. The space program influenced me. Yeah. And what is it going to be that's going to pull young people into the technical fields this next go around?
Real good. Well, look, it's a little past the top of the hour. Larry Burns, thanks so much for coming on. It's been great having you here on Out of Line After Hours. Before we go,
next week, Marjorie Krefsky, the woman who wrote Sirens of Chrome, which is kind of a documentation of the models, the career of modeling with automobiles over the years.
At auto shows.
At auto shows. And it's a pretty fascinating book, by the way. And she's going to be here with some iconic outfits from the eras with three young ladies who are going to have them on. So
it should be pretty cool. In fact,
be pretty cool.
One of the women coming in to model these vintage
dresses, the current Miss Michigan.
Is the current Miss Michigan. And I know Chip's got some pictures of it, of, you know, clothing that goes way back, you know. So it's going to be an interesting discussion, I think. It should be a pretty good show. But Frank Marcus, thank you for coming on. And we'll say Motor Trend again so people get that plug. And
always a pleasure.
Peter, the auto extremist, always good to be auto extreming on After Hours. So thanks much, and thank all of you for having tuned in. Visit our website, autolinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.